This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. It has been labeled the sharing economy, stuff you've heard of like Uber and Airbnb, things that might be less familiar like Poshmark, an app that allows shoppers to buy and sell used clothes and stuff, or Spinlister that lets you rent things like bikes, skis, and surfboards that have probably been collecting just in your garage. The shared economy is rapidly changing the way we work and play, but is it just business as usual with new technology, or are we facing fundamental changes? Duke Professor Michael Munger tackles the question in his new book, Tomorrow 3.0, Transaction Costs and the Shared Economy. He's the director of Philosophy, Politics, and Economics Program at Duke University, and he joins us now. Mike, welcome back.
It is great to be on the show, Frank.
Great to see you again. Tell us about the thesis behind this book. What are you talking about here?
Well, the simple version is that we have a set of three things that the combination is going to change the society that we live in. And the three things are these little portable communication devices that old people call phones, but young people don't use as phones. But there's a network of networks called the internet. And then there are a set of software that we write called apps. And you combine those three things, and it allows us to do something that's probably dangerous, and that's commodify excess capacity.
All right. Now, wait a minute. Commodify excess capacity. What are you talking about here?
Well, suppose I have a car in a few minutes, and you need a ride. Don't ask me how I know this, but if I pull up beside you and say, hey, you need a ride, it's bad.
Yeah.
But the fact is, there's probably a mutually beneficial transaction we could engage in if we could solve the problem of what economists call transaction costs. That means we have to find each other, we have to be able to pay each other or exchange, and we have to be able to trust each other. Hmm. Software can do all of those three things.
So that's what we have. Like Airbnb is a pretty good example of that, right? I've got a room that I'm not using. You may be in the market for a room. How do we find each other? Well, we've got this whole the technology that brings us together, and I get to get a little money from an unused room.
Right, and the hard thing is to be able to trust each other. The best example is actually BlaBlaCar. Now, I think you have a checkered past, Frank. So you used to hitchhike. Tell the truth.
I hitchhiked all the time, and I picked up hitchhikers.
I used to pick up hitchhikers. I no longer do.
Yeah. Right.
But when you think about it, you go out to I-40 or almost any road, you see someone driving and there's nobody sitting beside them. So BlaBlaCar gives you, in the Central Europe, people use BlaBlaCar all the time. It's an app that has four pieces of information. Where are you now? Where do you want to go? What time? And how much do you want to talk? So blah means I don't actually like other people very much. Blah, blah means enjoys a natter. Blah, blah, blah means rarely pauses even for breath, just likes to talk.
Okay.
So when you think about it, if I need to go somewhere, I shouldn't have to take a train. A bus is complicated. Uber is not a pure saving because that car wouldn't go otherwise.
Right.
Blah, blah, car is the pure selling of excess capacity. A truck driver who feels like talking a little bit finds someone else who wants to talk a little bit. They pay $10 for it. And I mean, hitchhiking, what you used to do is you'd go out on a road that went sort of where you were hoping to go and put your thumb out. That was your signal.
That was the deal.
Software is way better at that.
Yeah. And is money exchanged? Because with hitchhiking, there was no money.
There was no money, but there was a sort of you were trying to help each other out.
Yeah, yeah.
Here, it's a much smaller amount of money. And, you know, basically, I'm paying some part of your gas money. And probably if you hitchhiked a long way, you might have said, here's $5 for gas.
Sure.
So it's that we have that impulse to help each other.
That's right. And so this works that way. And you talk about it, especially when it comes to stuff. So if I own a drill and I use it twice a year, or in my case, never a year, why wouldn't there be a way that we could kind of share this drill? It gets used more often and we kind of bring down the cost.
Even if you use it a lot, but when you're not always using it, and that means that by sharing, we'll need less of it. The problem is that if we actually need less stuff and we make more efficient use of the enormous amount of stuff we already have, we'll have fewer jobs because we won't need to make as much stuff. Now, that's actually good.
Mm-hmm.
We shouldn't have to make and store and throw away such gigantic amounts of stuff. Our environmental footprint is just unconscionably large. I think people look back 50 years from now and say, why did they pay so much to store things to make sure nobody else got to use them when they could have shared them?
Right. And that you talk about this in your book as well, that there is a kind of a cultural shift that's taking place, so that where you and I might not want to share our lawnmower because it's mine. That's not really the thought these days. Millennials are far more willing to, you know, this.
Well, I think human beings since the beginning of time have been. There's been 150 or 200 years where we fetishize private property.
Yeah, that's right. And that's been very costly to all of us. It's been a demonic system that we're trapped in. But that does bring – so I want you to thread that out a little bit more before we get to the demonic system that I don't think will change just because of your software. But then you and I will talk. So do you see that happening? How does this work? Does somebody buy the thing and then share it, or is it still held in a common space where we are all sharing our drills?
Well, I think that's the exciting thing. I'm an economist, and so I fetishize markets and prices and private ownership. And I understand
that. Some economists, don't you?
Well, sometimes you have to step a little bit outside of that framework.
Yeah.
So it's perfectly true that if I am someone who uses a drill or tools most of the time, I could rent them out when I'm not using them. But there's interesting software for sharing that doesn't involve markets, which is tool libraries. So there's this open source software. I can just download it to our computer. There's 8 or 10 of us. We all agree that we'll take care of each other. If I need a tool on a particular Saturday, I can go pick it up. If I return it and it's broken, the other people in the community know. And you know, we have ways of solving that in the way that people have done for thousands of years. Mm-hmm. So that sort of sharing, I think, is on the horizon. And if you want to look for something to be optimistic about, the sharing process, not economy, but sharing process, will allow us to use a human impulse that has lain dormant.
Yeah, right. Humans are meant to share. We didn't get here by being greedy and selfish. If we were greedy and selfish from the beginning of time, we'd have been lost, you know, long before, shortly after we lost the dinosaurs. So we understand that sharing and communalism is who we are. And then we've had this brief interlude where we've become demons. You think we can actually get back to that or evolve in a different way. Here's your problem, Mike. What about the market? Somebody's got to own the place where the drill got made. And it's ownership that has been the creator of capital. The owner gets to generate capital, gets to take a little piece of my work for every hour that I show up. That becomes a big capital market. That's how the world goes around. What happens to all that?
Well, it's going to shrink, and it's going to shrink by a lot. I guess in terms of the drill, suppose that we didn't need the 110 million not very good power drills that we have now, but instead we need 7 or 8 good commercial quality drills. And they need to last longer, so you can't have planned obsolescence. So the demand is going to drive a relatively small number of high-quality producers. And in fact, we're seeing that happen already in a lot of cities where artisanal producers – when I was young, bread, milk, things like that were delivered to our house. You can get pickles and beautiful artisanal products if you live in New York delivered by Uber very cheaply. So I think there are some ways the market will still be involved. The nice thing about this is that suppose I do have a high quality drill or a bread maker. It actually can now be a source of income. My son, who lives in New York, Lower East Side, New York, lives in a nicer apartment than he could otherwise afford, precisely because he is able to rent it out on Airbnb for about a month a year. So the market may help us share things. What's going to end, I think, is this impulse to own. I'm old. You look at my Facebook page, you see my stupid BMW and my oversized house. My son, you see him hang gliding in Nepal. Young people want to collect experiences, not be tied down with a bunch of stuff.
But does this mean, because what this really does suggest, and again, if you think about the changes in software and with 3D printer technology and all of that, we can actually design in small communities precisely what that small community needs. We can reconfigure ourselves. So if I think I'm Frank the handyman at home, might get together with a bunch of people and say, couldn't we come up with a better drill and do that? And then if I'm, you know, Frank the bicyclist, I could talk about that. Those small communities would be the inventors, the creators, the designers, and the consumers. Is that what you're envisioning? These kind of multiple small communities making and doing for themselves, perhaps within a larger body, perhaps not?
Well, that's one thing I'm envisioning. That's the optimistic side.
Yeah.
I've become more and more to admire Karl Marx's ability to predict almost exactly what was going to happen with capitalism.
About
the sort
time,
of cycle.
Mike.
Well, I've always believed that.
Right.
I mean, when you look at the Communist Manifesto in 1848 was written in the face of what he thought was imminent revolution. The cities of Europe were on fire. And what he said about capitalism proved the sort of, I don't know if I would call it contradictions, because he also said capitalism was necessary for the accumulation of capital and the building of stuff. So we couldn't have done without it. The commodification, it couldn't have been done without it. The question is, what's going to happen now? I worry that the owners of large, heavily capitalized corporations that sell stock and that depend on the current system for their value are going to fight back.
They've been doing that.
Well, I mean on fire again. I mean back to literally the cities being on fire.
So tell me how that plays out, because you can see it. I mean, you've got in the fossil fuel industry, these are the people who control the economy, and they control very much, have an enormous impact on our political. There's nobody who wants air pollution. There's nobody who wants an early death for their grandchild, which is what fossil fuels do for us. That's already on the EPA website. So, and yet these industries continue to make the claim that they're better for us in the long run and that they're not going to go away. You're saying that there's not some sort of easy political way around this, that this is going to end in a bitter fight with fire and brimstone.
Well, of course, if people would listen to me and maybe even to you. I mean, I've changed my mind about a lot of things. I actually think that one way to reduce the impact of these inevitable changes on people, on regular people, is to have single-payer health care and universal basic income.
Say that again, Mike, because you're the libertarian. Government.
I took a libertarian road. There's a lot of libertarians, to be fair. Charles Murray is in favor of universal basic income. And the reason is that we all benefit. There's two reasons. We all benefit from having access to this sort of really vibrant, innovative economy. The second thing is that many people are harmed by that through no fault of their own. They played by the rules. They got a job, and now it's going to disappear. So for those two reasons, since we think it's inevitable and it's better overall, we should reduce the impact on those who, through no fault of their own, lose everything. Plus, that means that they're then able to participate rather than relegating, consigning them to the dustbin.
Right. They participate, and the money that's spent in their behalf by this big, ugly giant called the government, so excoriated over the past 38 years, actually generates revenue in the same way that other capital markets can benefit by this. But again, I want to get your sense of how it will play out. I mean, you've talked about one sort of giant market, a shared economy. The shared economy for health, clean air, clean water is a shared economy. But there's no producer. Right. And that's been our problem. What role does a government play in producing clean air and by preventing dirty air for this giant market? So are these two things at odds, because these big markets, these giant dinosaurs called and by the way, the fact that you're coming to the idea of social democracy about 38 years late, Mike, is charming. But it raises exactly that question. That was what social democracy was all about. That was the theory of social democracy. It died 38 years ago and it has not been resurrected. How do you see it playing out? Is there just a sort of a giant rumble and then we recollect ourselves? Or do you imagine some kind of rational political process that gets us there?
Well, rational political process, I've never actually heard that phrase work out very well. Process, I'll give you, but rational and political, probably not. I guess I see that there's a sort of paroxysm. I'm encouraged by the paroxysm, the response of the ancien regime economically to the fact that we're undergoing these threats. I mean, here's what I see happening is we're going to make some attempts that are going to fail and we're going to need some alternative. So Seattle just raised the minimum wage to $13 an hour, tried to give a living wage. The result is that the number of hours for people who work at minimum wage has fallen by 30%. If you go into a fast food restaurant everywhere, they turn the cash register around. So instead of somebody behind the cash register, I just punch the keys. All of those people are going to lose their jobs. You go to a Hertz counter in the airport, a rental counter, there's no workers. So we're losing workers on every front, and they're not going to find something else instead. So the question is, politically, are those people going to be captured by demagogues who appeal to nationalism and xenophobia? I think in the short run, the answer is yes.
Short run, that's what we've seen happen. Yes. And so then how that plays out. Well, let's talk about the commodification, because the other response that the capitalist owners will now take, and they're doing it, Uber's a pretty good example. We talk about this kind of hipster thing, shared economy, it's all about sharing. No, it's about a corporation owning other people's work still and using new technology to own other people's work and exploit those drivers. And by the way, drive other cab drivers out of work, which is, you know.
Well, I think Uber is more complicated. I think there's an argument for something like Uber And partly because the taxis have done not a very good job of adapting. But Airbnb, I used to be optimistic about, Airbnb is corrosive. It turns out that Airbnb, instead of being a way to share one bedroom in my apartment, is a way for someone with money to buy up an entire block of apartments and then run it as a hotel. In city after city, Reykjavik, London, Paris, there's a severe shortage of low-income housing because I'm way better off charging $200 a night than I am $1,000 a month. And Airbnb, by commodifying excess capacity, economic revolutions do not care whether we like them. They don't care whether they're good for us. They just follow a certain logic. That's their beauty, and that's their tragedy.
But what? So what's to prevent that from happening again? If Airbnb is the better example, once we figure out where everybody's gone, we simply grab it, own it, and turn it into to shareholder profit.
We will try to regulate it, and we will fail.
That's
why I see fire.
No, but what about now? Here's okay. So and you're right to be pessimistic on that front. But on the other front, let's go back to the technology. Let's talk about open source. Is there a way in which, try as they might to corner this, commodify it, and turn it into some kind of crazy corrosive derivative? I can just write software that will undermine them. They can't own this software.
We're going to win. Humanity is going to win. We're going to overcome the institutions that have been such a problem. But the reason the title of my book is Tomorrow 3.0 is I'm saying that there was the Neolithic Revolution, the Industrial Revolution, and then the new commodification revolution. And the Neolithic Revolution was tragic for hundreds of years. The average height of human beings went down by 20%. We lived very badly. It's just that we could support 1,000 times as many people.
You're talking about the agricultural revolution.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
10,000 years ago, worst thing that ever happened. I would have voted against the agricultural revolution.
If someone had asked, yes.
Horrible. Yeah.
Well,
as you suggested, the economy didn't care because we won because we kept producing more humans, albeit sicker, smaller, dumber, and more violent.
Yes.
Yeah. That was a horrible thing. I wish I could have voted. So go ahead. Neolithic, bad for humanity.
Well, and then the Industrial Revolution is bad for humanity.
Oh, my God. That was a horror.
Well, but then before long, people could afford clothing.
Yeah,
poor people could get clothing that only the very wealthy could have had a little while ago.
At the cost of their souls.
Economic revolutions don't care.
Keep going.
So the question is, I think ultimately we're going to get through this.
Yeah.
But economic revolutions don't care about our souls.
But it's not been progressively better. Wouldn't you say progressively worse? I mean, I think in many ways.
No, poverty around the world has fallen dramatically.
Yeah, but you have to, again, if you talk about a poor turnip farmer who's working from sunup to sundown, we're all working harder today than we were before that Neolithic Revolution and before the Industrial Revolution. Those turnip farmers only worked sunup to sundown. They may have looked poor, but that's a better life than people here.
You want to have a human zoo with just a few people. It turns out that having a bunch more people, if you get to the point where you start educating them, the population growth is going to slow down.
Yeah.
We're actually seeing population growth slowing down as a consequence of the wealth that has been accumulated by exactly that thing that we detest.
All right. So you think because the other thing is that the demagogic leaders have also suppressed education.
That's politics. That's
they
not market.
Really want it.
I'm with you on that.
Mike Munger, always a stimulating conversation. Tomorrow 3.0.
Frank's ready to fight here.
No, I'm so surprised you've come around to social democracy that I'm just enthralled. I think it's great stuff. Michael Munger is the director of the Philosophy, Politics, and Economics program at Duke University, and you can see why. He's also the author of the book Tomorrow 3.0, Transaction Cost and the Shared Economy. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Mike, what a pleasure, as always.
It was great.
We got some music coming up on the State of Things. Isabel Taylor, stay tuned.